Imagine buying a $50 million mansion.
Right.
But every single day, the environment around it is just actively trying to dissolve its foundation.
Yeah, saltwater is brutal.
And on top of that, the government is constantly demanding to inspect its plumbing. Oh, and it costs you like $5 million a year in pure cash just to keep the lights on and pay the staff.
And you have to steer it through international waters.
Exactly. That is the reality of buying a super yacht.
It's a perfect way to frame it, really. I mean, you
Yeah.
aren't buying a static luxury object that just sits in a vault somewhere. You're buying a highly complex, incredibly demanding floating machine.
Yeah.
It is the absolute definition of an active operational burden.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are looking directly at, a brutally honest insider document. It's called the yachtindustry.pdf report.
It's a fascinating read.
It really is, because our mission today is to strip away all that Instagram filter romance of yachting. We want to uncover the stark operational, economic, and psychological realities of owning one of these floating luxury assets.
Which is a lot more intense than people think.
Oh, for sure. We're getting into the hidden machinery of extreme wealth here. So, whether you're listening right now just out of sheer curiosity about how the ultra-rich actually spend their money.
Or maybe you're secretly plotting a massive acquisition of your own.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Either way, you're going to leave this deep dive armed with the reality of things like the 10 to 15% rule and the vanity trap.
And setting the tone right up front, this report establishes a really cold, practical baseline.
Yeah, it doesn't pull any punches.
No, not at all. It says for anyone entering this market, the most important question is not, can you afford the purchase price?
Right.
The real question is, can you afford the asset? Can you afford the crew, the maintenance, the compliance, the mistakes?
The downtime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And eventually, the exit.
Because buying the boat is basically just paying the cover charge to enter a very, very expensive club.
That's a great analogy.
Okay, let's unpack this. The report has this central thesis, right?
Yeah.
It insists on calling a yacht a pleasure asset, but it explicitly warns against calling it an investment.
Yes.
But people always talk about billionaires, investing in a super yacht. Why is that the wrong word?
Because treating a yacht as a conventional investment is a fundamental error. It leads to massive financial regret.
Interesting.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the report outlines what it calls the buyer-grade mental model.
Okay, what's that?
Well, to survive yacht ownership, you have to view the vessel through five distinct lenses simultaneously.
Five lenses, okay.
First, it is an asset, but specifically a depreciating one.
Right, like a car.
Worse than a car. Its resale value depends entirely on relentless maintenance, strict engine hour logging, and maintaining its class status.
Wait, let me stop you there. When you say class status, are we talking about something like a DMV inspection for boats, or is it something more intense?
Oh, it's far more intense.
Really?
Yeah. Think of a classification society like Lloyd's Register, for example.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly strict, ongoing commercial building code mixed with aviation level safety checks.
Wow. Aviation level.
Yeah, they dictate the engineering standards, how the hull is welded, how the fire systems operate.
So it's not just a quick walk around.
Not at all. And if your yacht loses its class status because you skipped some maintenance, its value just plummets. You often can't legally insure it, and you might not even be able to move it.
Okay, so the saltwater is trying to destroy it from the outside,
Yeah.
and the regulatory bodies are scrutinizing it from the inside.
Exactly. Which leads to the second lens. It's an operating business.
Right.
A yacht is basically a hospitality operation. It requires payroll, procurement, accounting, and compliance.
It's a floating corporation.
Basically, yeah. Third, it's a private space. It's a movable compound offering rare privacy for the owner.
Makes sense.
Fourth, it functions as a status instrument. But, that can help or hurt your reputation depending on tax optics and public scrutiny.
Oh, like if you're seen flaunting wealth during an economic downturn or something.
Precisely. And fifth, it's a network platform.
Meaning you use it to host business partners, close deals, that sort of thing.
Yes, but it's a sharp, double-edged sword.
How so?
Well, a yacht concentrates influential guests in one place, sure, but it also heavily concentrates your legal exposure.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Think about it. You've got alcohol, complex crew dynamics, potential guest injuries, and you're moving across international borders with, customs and tax questions.
Sounds like a lawyer's nightmare.
It can be. Every time the boat moves, it creates legal and reputational risk. So, going back to your first question, it is not a yield asset.
Right.
Unless you are running a strictly managed, highly disciplined commercial charter business, which is incredibly tough, a yacht just does not make you money.
Okay, so if a yacht is actually this complex, high-risk, floating institution, I imagine the absolute worst thing a buyer could do is buy the wrong type of institution.
Precisely. A mismatch between the yacht's physical capabilities, its mission, basically, and the owner's actual lifestyle is the classic source of massive financial waste.
Because you end up with what? Too much crew?
Too much crew, insufficient range, or just totally unnecessary mechanical complexity.
Which brings us to the categories. The report scales things up to illustrate this.
Right.
On the smaller recreational end, you have day boats. Those are in the 25 to 55 foot range.
Perfect for a quick trip out.
Yeah. Then you have sport fishing yachts with those very narrow, high-speed offshore missions.
Yeah.
And catamarans that give you wide deck space for places like the Caribbean.
Yeah, catamarans are huge down there.
Then you hit standard motor yachts. But then, and this is where it gets interesting, the report draws a massive red line at the super yacht category.
Yes, the 24-meter mark.
Right. It specifically notes a threshold of 24 meters, which is about 79 feet. Why is that specific length so critical?
Because 24 meters is where physics and international maritime law basically intersect. That is the large yacht boundary under major commercial yacht codes.
So it's not just a vanity metric. It's not just about bragging rights.
Not at all. At 24 meters, the mass of the vessel, the mechanical complexity, the blind spots from the bridge, they reach a point where governments say, look, this is no longer a pleasure boat you can just take out on Sundays with your friends.
Right. You can't just toss the keys to your buddy.
Exactly. They say this is a commercial grade ship. Above 24 meters, professional crew certifications, strict safety requirements, flag state rules, and that class-like discipline we talked about, they all become legally mandatory.
Wow. So it completely transitions from recreational boating to serious maritime operations.
It's a completely different ballgame. And above that, you get into mega yacht.
Right, the 60 to 80 meters plus.
Yeah, where the report literally describes their operating burden as having state-like complexity.
State-like complexity. That is wild.
You also see explorer yachts in that upper tier. They're built for autonomy, you know, with thick ice-class hulls for remote cruising.
Like going to Antarctica or something.
Exactly. Though the report dryly notes that the rugged expedition claims of these owners often far exceed their actual use.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah, most of them never actually leave the Mediterranean.
I love that little dose of reality. Just parking an icebreaker next to a beach club in Monaco.
Pretty much.
Now, speaking of reality, let's talk about builders. Because the report contrasts production builders like Azimut and Princess, which are essentially luxury assembly lines.
Right. Very high-end, but still production.
Exactly. And it contrasts them with semi-custom yards like Westport. And then the absolute peak, you have the blank page, full-custom mega yacht builders.
The Lursons, the Feed Ships, the Ocean's Goes.
Right. But I have to ask, if I just had a massive liquidity event and I have unlimited money, why wouldn't I go straight to Oceanoco, sit down with a blank piece of paper, and just build my ultimate dream boat?
What's fascinating here is that if you do that, you will almost certainly fall into what the industry calls the vanity trap.
The vanity trap.
Yeah. Yeah. First-time earners are explicitly warned to be incredibly cautious about full custom builds.
Why? Is it just because of construction delays? Like it takes too long?
No, it's deeper than that. It's about ego versus practicality.
Okay.
A proven pre-owned platform teaches a family office what the owner actually needs and how they genuinely live on the water.
So you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. Imagine a billionaire who insists on a custom, over-engineered glass bottom pool on the upper deck.
Just because it looks incredible in an architectural rendering.
Right. And it does look amazing until the engineering reality of a twisting hull in heavy seas causes the glass to crack.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Resulting in millions of dollars in damages and a 2-year shipyard delay. You built for your ego, not for your mission.
So the trap is falling in love with a concept that doesn't actually work in salt water.
Yes. The irony here is that prestige actually works backward in the yachting world.
What do you mean?
Well, an iconic brand premium can sometimes exceed its practical utility. The report warns that slapping a famous badge on a poorly maintained custom yacht is not a flex at all.
Yes.
A lesser-known brand that has been meticulously maintained with perfect documentation and a strictly disciplined engine room is a vastly superior asset to some neglected prestige build.
That makes total sense. You want the machine that actually runs, not the one that just looks good in Architectural Digest.
Exactly.
So, assuming you survive the vanity trap and you decide what you need, you actually have to buy the thing.
Which is an ordeal in itself.
Let's talk about the purchase workflow. Because the report contrasts the glamorous romance of a luxury boat show with the brutal, boring necessity of engineering due diligence.
It's an absolute gauntlet. Professional buyers slow the process way down.
Right.
The very first stage isn't even shopping. It's sitting down and writing down a rigid use profile.
Mimishing.
Exactly. Then the second stage is building the budget. And the report demands three separate models here.
Three budgets.
Yeah. You need the acquisition cost, the annual operation cost, and a five-year life cycle projection.
Because treating the sticker price as the actual cost of ownership is a total rookie mistake.
Completely. Then, after that, comes breaker selection, shortlisting, making an offer, and finally, the survey and sea trial.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me. I want to look at the choice between a new build and a pre-owned yacht.
It's a huge decision.
Because with a new build, you're looking at a 2 to 5 year timeline. You have massive project management overhead and the risk of constant change orders.
Yeah, the costs can spiral quickly.
But with pre-owned, you get immediate gratification. You can literally be on the water next month.
True, but...
you might be inheriting a mechanical nightmare. Buying a pre-owned yacht for its beautiful interior without rigorously checking the engine room is like buying a used Ferrari purely because you like the leather seats.
While ignoring that the transmission is about to explode.
Exactly. The seats are a cheap fix, but the transmission will bankrupt you.
That is the exact dynamic at play here. And that is why the survey is not ceremonial.
It's not just a quick look.
No, it is not just one guy walking around with a clipboard checking fire extinguishers. Mm-hmm. On larger yachts, one surveyor is completely useless.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You need a team of specialists. You need someone for the hull, someone for the machinery, paint thickness, the rigging, the complex AV and IT systems, and of course, those critical class items.
And what if the seller's paperwork is messy? Like they can't find the logs?
That is a massive red flag.
Yeah.
If you see vague captain logs or missing maintenance history, you have to treat it as a major financial liability, not just a paperwork inconvenience.
Wow.
Impatience is the wealthy buyer's biggest enemy here. Bad purchases always start with a tight deadline, a flashy presentation, or a desire to, you know, display wealth immediately.
But wait, what about the yacht broker? If they're guiding you through this whole gauntlet, aren't they protecting you from these landmines?
Well, a broker filters the market and negotiates the deal, sure. But because they generally work on a percentage commission of the sale price, their ultimate incentive is for the transaction to close.
Ah, right.
You cannot rely solely on them. The report strongly advises buyers to retain their own independent legal, tax, survey, and technical advisors.
You need your own team.
Always.
Okay, so... you survive this purchase gauntlet, you bring in your independent team, you dodge the bad transmissions, the boat is finally yours. You'd think the financial bleeding is over.
You'd think so.
But legally and operationally, buying the yacht is just day one.
Very true.
Let's look at the operational ecosystem, because this is where the numbers completely blew my mind.
This is the reality check part of the report. The industry rule of thumb is that annual running costs are roughly 10 to 15% of the yacht's initial purchase value.
Hold on. 10 to 15%
yeah.
Every single year.
Every single year.
Let's do the math on that. If I buy a $150 million custom mega yacht, you're telling me I have to find another $15 to $22 million in cash every 12 months.
Yep.
Where's all that money actually going?
It basically vanishes into the daily operations of a floating micro city.
Wow.
Let's look at the illustrative budget breakdown the report gives us. Crew salaries and benefits make up the largest chunk. That's about 32%.
Okay, so almost a third just on payroll.
Right. Then maintenance and refit reserves, because things are constantly breaking in salt water, that takes up 28%.
Makes sense.
Fuel and lubricants are around 12%. Berthing and dockage is 8%. And insurance is 7%.
So what does this all mean? Just to put that in perspective for smaller boats, the report notes that even a modest 70-foot motor yacht, which, you know, might cost $2 to $5 million to buy, will still demand $200,000 to $700,000 annually.
Just to exist.
Just to exist. Now, if I am burning millions a year just on deckhand payroll and hall paying, who is actually managing this? Because I can't imagine a billionaire CEO is sitting at a desk doing payroll for a chef and ordering replacement oil filters.
Oh, definitely not. Once a yacht crosses that regulatory threshold we talked about, management is not optional.
Right.
This introduces the yacht management company.
Okay, what do they do?
These are specialized firms that handle everything. Crew employment, international payroll, accounting, procurement, and crucial regulatory compliance like the ISM.
The ISM.
The International Safety Management Code.
Got it. So the owner's name is on the LLC that owns the boat, but they aren't really running it.
Exactly. And the report makes a profound distinction here. It says the owner holds the title, but the captain and the management company dictate whether the asset is actually safe, compliant, and legally available to use.
They hold the real power.
Operationally, yes. And a huge part of that compliance involves the flag state.
The flag state, like where the boat is physically registered? Because I always see yachts with flags from like the Cayman Islands or Malta.
Yes. You don't just register a super yacht at your local DMV.
Right.
Jurisdictions like the Cayman Islands, the Marshall Islands, or Malta have specialized maritime legal frameworks. The flag state dictates the safety rules the yacht must follow, the crew credential requirements, and it significantly impacts the owner's tax exposure.
So it's a huge strategic decision.
Massive.
And I imagine the insurance companies are breathing down their necks about this stuff, too.
Oh, absolutely. Insurance is described in a report not just as a financial policy, but as a discipline imposed on the owner.
A discipline.
Yeah. The insurer enforces the survey requirements, sets strict navigation limits, and demands detailed hurricane evacuation plans.
Well, they don't mess around.
No. If you have a high-value yacht moving between the Mediterranean and the Caribbean, you need active professional risk management.
Okay, so you have millions of dollars flying out the door every year just to keep the boat insured, crewed, and compliant.
Endless cash burn.
To offset these astronomical carrying costs, owners inevitably look to charter their yachts out to other wealthy people. Which brings us to the charter market.
A very misunderstood topic.
Right, because I've always wondered, is chartering essentially just a high-end Airbnb side hustle for the ultra-rich?
This raises an important question, actually. It is entirely different from Airbnb, and the report forcefully debunks that exact comparison.
Really? How so?
You cannot just put your private yacht on the market like it's a spare bedroom. A privately registered yacht requires an entirely different set of commercial certifications, safety equipment, and crew licensing to legally accept paying guests.
Especially if it's over 24 meters.
Especially then.
So you have to decide beforehand. Am I a private vessel or a commercial operation?
Yes, you have to commit. And from an economic standpoint, the math is sobering.
It does make money.
The report states clearly, do not buy a yacht because the potential charter revenue sounds persuasive. Charter should be modeled strictly as partial cost recovery.
Right, never as a standalone profit engine.
Never.
Let's talk about how the client actually pays for a charter. Because the headline rate you see online isn't the whole story at all. I see yachts listed for, say, $500,000 a week, but that's just the baseline.
Right, that's just the base rate. It covers the yacht itself and the cruise time.
Okay.
But a yacht is essentially an empty platform. To actually use it, the client has to pay the APA.
The APA. The Advanced Provisioning Allowance. How does that work?
Think of the APA as the client pre-funding a massive debit card for the captain.
Okay.
It adds roughly 25 to 40% on top of the base rate. The captain uses that fund to buy the fuel, the food, the dockage fees, and the alcohol.
So it's all the consumables?
Exactly. If the guests request a $10,000 bottle of wine, the captain buys it using the APA.
So a $500,000 week easily becomes a $700,000 week.
Easily.
But even if the owner is pulling in that kind of revenue,
mm-hmm.
there's a massive physical toll on the boat, isn't there?
Huge. Charter guests party differently than owners do.
It's a rental car mentality.
Basically, yeah.
Mm.
They inflict serious wear and tear on the interior, the water toys, and the engineering systems. Chartering aggressively accelerates the depreciation of the asset.
That makes sense.
Furthermore, repeat charter business relies just as much on the quality of the chef and the cruise service as it does on the yacht's actual design.
It's all about the experience. Right. And there's a scheduling conflict too, right?
An inherent one, yeah. The prime weeks, an owner actually wants to use their own yacht, say, the Mediterranean in August or St. Bart's over New Year's.
Right, the peak seasons.
Those are the exact same weeks the charter market demands top dollar. So you often have to give up your own vacation to make the math work.
Which kind of defeats the purpose of buying it. Let's talk about where this is all physically happening. Because the report maps out the global hubs where this entire ecosystem manifests. And it's a very rigid seasonal circuit.
It revolves entirely around the weather. The Mediterranean absolutely dominates the summer charter season.
Places like Monaco, the French Riviera, the Greek islands.
Exactly. Then, as winter hits Europe, the fleet migrates across the Atlantic to the Caribbean.
The Bahamas, St. Bart's, Antigua.
Yeah.
And South Florida seems to be the logistical engine room for the whole U.S. and Caribbean market.
Florida is the central hub for brokerage, major shipyard refits, and crew training.
Right.
And the report highlights the major industry events that physically drive this economy. For example, looking ahead to the industry calendar, the Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show is scheduled for October 28th to November 1st, 2026.
Okay.
And the premier global event, the Monaco Yacht Show, is listed for September 23rd to 26th, 2026.
This is a very packed schedule.
And these aren't just boat shows. Right. They are massive B2B networking events for the entire supply chain.
So it's business, not just showing off.
Very much so. You also have emerging nodes like Dubai servicing Gulf wealth and Singapore acting as a gateway for Asian family offices.
It's incredible. It really is a traveling, self-contained, global ecosystem of extreme wealth.
Which brings us to the final and maybe most fascinating part of this deep dive.
The psychology of it.
Yeah. We've talked about the engineering, the finances, the grueling legalities. But psychologically, what does a superyacht actually mean to the people who buy them?
The report concludes with a very sharp psychological assessment. It notes that a yacht is one of the clearest modern symbols of surplus wealth.
Right.
And it's precisely because it has limited practical necessity, highly visible costs, and massive hidden costs.
It's the ultimate conspicuous consumption.
Yes. That combination makes it both a powerful tool and a dangerous liability.
It can produce immense joy and leverage, but if managed poorly, it produces endless frustration and reputational damage.
Exactly. The final takeaway centers on owner maturity.
How so?
Well, the psychologically mature owner treats the yacht as an expensive, highly managed tool for a defined life strategy.
Okay, so maybe that's creating an isolated family refuge or operating a controlled business development platform. Right. They respect the machinery, they understand what it is, but the immature owner treats the yacht purely as a trophy.
They fall into the vanity trap we talked about earlier.
Right. And that immature owner is the one who is later completely shocked by the reality of the multi-million-dollar payrolls, the rigid class surveys, the complex crew politics, and the relentless shipyard refits.
It all comes back to that initial shift in perspective. A yacht is a beautiful, deeply complex floating institution.
Yes, it is.
It requires a buyer to master their own ego, budget ruthlessly, and build a team of independent experts just to keep the lights on and the paint shining.
It demands discipline. Without that discipline, the asset ends up owning you.
Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over. You know, we've just spent this entire deep dive uncovering the massive hidden operational footprint of these vessels.
It's staggering when you look at the real numbers.
It really is. Every nautical mile traveled, every gallon of diesel burned, yep. Every crew member hired, it all creates a highly visible data point in the real world. So given that reality, how will the intense growing public scrutiny on the environmental and social optics of extreme wealth fundamentally change the actual design and the desirability of superyachts for the next generation of billionaires?
That is the existential question the entire industry is going to have to answer moving forward.
It really is. You know, we started out talking about how luxury objects usually just sit safely in a garage or a vault.
Gathering dust.
Right. But when you buy a superyacht, you're buying a machine that saltwater is constantly trying to sink.
Yeah.
And the regulatory state is constantly trying to audit. The transaction never really ends. It just evolves.
Beautifully put.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.